I'm very excited to be speaking with Dr. Arik Kirschenbaum. He is a zoologist from Cambridge University who studies the evolution of communication and cooperation in various species, including wolves and dolphins. And he's also the author of The Zoologist's Guide to the Galaxy, a very interesting book, which you might call An Introduction to Astrobiology. He writes about some of the universal features of life on Earth that we might expect to find in alien life as well. Arik, welcome to the Nature and Nurture podcast.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for taking the time to be here. So I'd love to hear, in your own words, a brief overview of this book and the work you're doing.
So the work that I do is on animal communication, how animals talk to each other, what they say, why they say it, how these things evolved. And really, when you look at the way that animals communicate and the different techniques they use for communicating, there are some very sort of consistent trends, right? It's not everything goes. There are certain ways that animals communicate. They communicate with sound, right? There's only a few things you can do with sound. You know, there's different ways you could put information and messages in sound. There's not an infinite number of ways. So this idea that there are solutions to problems that life faces, problems of communicating, but there aren't an infinite number of solutions, is really key to the book. I mean, what I'm saying here is that when we think about what life on other planets will be like, we may tend to think that, oh, it could be anything. But no, it couldn't be anything, right? There are some real constraints as to how life works, how things can move, how things can communicate. And those constraints that exist across the universe, we see them right here. We see them here on Earth. We see animals that don't communicate with telepathy. It's not going to work. It's not going to work on another planet. Also, we see animals communicate with sound. Sounds great. You know, if you've got an atmosphere, if you've got enough of a thick enough atmosphere for sound to travel, it's a really good way of communicating. It's going to be the same on other planets as well.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And you did focus mostly on animals in this book, as opposed to, like, I guess there's more exotic forms of communication. Like, I've heard, for example, when grass gets cut, it releases like some pheromone to let the other grass know that, I guess, there's danger around.
Yeah, I concentrated on animals throughout the book for a couple of reasons. I mean, one, because I'm a zoologist, so that's what I study, that's what I do. But there's a bit more to it than that, because one of the things about animals that's really important and really obvious, right, is that we're animals. And a lot of the things about humans that we think of being very, very unique and very unique to humans, we can't help asking ourselves, well, are aliens going to be like that as well? But those characteristics that we have because we are animals. We face the main problems that animals face, how to move around, how to find other members of our species to mate with, and things like how to cooperate. These are things that many, many species of animals face. They're the things that we look at in ourselves and say, wow, this is really human. You know, we build cities and we cooperate to do this and that, and we have language. Those are animal characteristics. We don't see those sorts of things among plants. Communicate, sure, I'm not saying they don't, but that kind of communication that animals do, that's different, and that's special, and that's something like us, and something that alien animals will have as well.
Right. It seems like, so we start off with these sort of similar drives, and then the more complex you get, the more nuanced it gets, but we're all sort of chasing the same basic needs, like I guess food, reproduction, shelter, stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that really makes a difference between plants and animals on Earth is the way that animals move. So plants are happy to stay where they are and gather their sunlight and get their nutrients like that. And with a few exceptions, you know, the seeds have got to move and things like that. But really, animals are occupying that niche of going out and getting stuff, going out and getting food, getting mates. And it's that movement that really, A, gives them their typical characteristics, but B, it really dictates the kinds of problems they're going to have to solve. And so the kinds of intelligence they're going to have to evolve if they're going to solve those problems. So it's that movingness that really gives animals that extra interesting bit of behavior.
Mm-hmm. So at what point did you decide to focus on studying animal communication as opposed to movement or some other process?
Well, this goes right back to when I started my research. So I actually when I started my PhD, I was not studying animal communication. I was studying movement, and I was studying movement of a small animal called a hyrax. And their movement's really important because they also carry diseases. And it was interesting to see how they move and whether they're near, you know, humans and settlements, or whether they're like out in the wilderness and things like that. So movement was what was interesting. But they make so much noise. These animals make so much noise that I couldn't help studying them. I couldn't help thinking, wow, why are they making so much noise? And this was like, so my research just went into this direction of communication.
Mm-hmm. What's a hyrax closest to in terms of visualizing it?
Well, in terms of visualizing it, you can imagine something between a guinea pig and a rabbit. They're not closely related to either of them. They're very distantly mm-hmm. related to any other living species. And in fact, people often say that they're most closely related to elephants. Wow. Which at first sounds like an unhelpful comparison, but actually, if you look at their paws, they've got these little like sort of stubby fingers, and they do kind of look like elephant feet. So if you imagine an elephant shrunk down to the size of a rabbit, with no trunk, they've got little tusks, but they haven't got a trunk, wow. and furry, and that's what they are.
That's so interesting. So it both in your work and more generally for zoologists, it seems like a lot of people end up studying these niche species that most people have never heard of. So how does that happen? How do you come across a hyrax, or really anything?
Well, I mean, zoologists, like any other scientist, our aim is to understand the processes, why things happen, right? Mm-hmm. We're not really into documenting things. People, 100 years ago, people managed to document pretty much everything there is. So now our job is to find out why things are the way they are. And obviously, you know, the species that we all know about, horses, dogs, cats, right? We know quite a lot about why they are the way they are. Not everything. There's still plenty of people who study well-known animals. But what's really interesting about weird and wonderful animals is that quite often they have behaviors that you just don't see anywhere else, right? So particularly if they're animals that are very closely adapted to a very specific niche, then they'll have particular mechanisms, particular ways of surviving in that niche. And then the question is, wow, why did they get that, right? You know, how did they evolve to have, for instance, in the case of the hyraxes, why do hyraxes sing these long songs? I mean, it's pretty weird. It's just a strange thing. You don't see this in other mammals at all. They seem more like birds in many ways.
Is it like a mating ritual?
Yeah, I mean, these are in fact sexually selected characteristics. These are the dominant males. They're telling the females how attractive they are. They're telling the other males how strong they are. So we know roughly that's why it happens. But why so complicated, right? Why are they singing complex songs like birds when other mammals don't do that? And these kinds of questions often get to some really, really, really fundamental issues, like what information is there in animal communication, right? How much do they actually talk about? That's not a very well understood topic. We know most animals say very little, right? They say, look out, it's a lion, or come mate with me, or something like that. That's about the limit of what they say. But clearly we say more than that. So right. how do we get that? How do we build our language on top of this very, very simple communication? Some very interesting questions there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So from there, from studying those interesting songs of the hyraxes, you became more interested in studying communication generally.
Yeah. And then you look for parallels, you know, you look at parallels amongst other species and you say, okay, well, hyraxes do this. Or, well, what's the next most similar thing to you? I also was working with dolphins at the time, and that led me straight into working with wolves, because wolves and dolphins, surprising as it sounds, actually very, very similar. I mean, the communication is very, very similar. Wow. And that raises a lot of questions. You know, we speak with words. We speak with words and sentences, and we put words together, and the way you put them together makes a different sentence, has a different meaning. Some animals, like dolphins and wolves, don't do that. They don't have words. They have nothing that you could call a word. In fact, all the sounds they make are all continuously variable. You know, they vary the pitch up and down in a very continuous way. And that's so different from how we think about conveying information that there's another excellent question. Why do they do it this way? You know, why don't they use words or notes like a bird song? Bird songs made up of different notes, very simple. Notes in this order is one thing. Notes in a different order might be another thing. It's not like that with dolphins.
Mm-hmm. So you could imagine a person speaking very continuously, just without the normal pauses you would normally put. And if you spoke the language, or you could also imagine like on a keyboard, just a whole bunch of words without any spaces, you can usually read it if you know the language and if you have some context, but then if it's a different language, you'll have no luck. So is there any chance that there are these ways, like there are words hidden in their songs and it's just, we don't know how to decipher them?
Well, I would rather than saying, okay, humans speak with words and dolphins seem really intelligent and they talk a lot. So maybe dolphins speak with words, right? Rather than taking that approach, which might be right, I mean, I don't know, could be right. But it seems to make more sense to look at why the dolphins are using this particular kind of communication and then work from the sort of the evolutionary explanation forward. So, okay, we know why dolphins don't use words, right? They don't use words because they're communicating underwater, and underwater, like with wolves from one mountain to another, there's a lot of attenuation, there's a lot of sound loss. So they kind of have to use this particular method. Their whistles go up and down, you know, that's the only way you can get information across underwater. So that's their evolutionary requirement. So we wouldn't expect them to have words because they're building their communication on the requirements of the environment in which they live. So it doesn't really make sense to look for words with dolphins. It makes more sense to think about, okay, given that we communicate this, that they communicate this way, how then can they put information in? And that's what we're doing. That's the way we do it.
Right. It seems like I'm so used to our language that I use words as a stand-in for information, but information is the real fundamental part that you talk about in your book that might be the universal thing.
Yeah, to a large extent. I mean, that's one position you could take is that really what animals are doing is conveying information. There are people who argue that's not what they're doing. You know, there are many animals who we don't think they are consciously, intentionally putting information into their communication. Could be just instinctive, right? When a bird sings a song, pretty likely they're doing this instinctively. They may have learned it, but it's an instinctive response. Are they thinking, I want to tell the next door neighbor that you know, he shouldn't come into my territory? Probably not. Maybe, but probably not. So we just need to be a little bit careful about things like what they intend to do, how much information they put in. It's really an exercise in not projecting our own ideas onto animals that are very unlike us.
So how about in our very early ancestral past, does that mean that our communication started off as this more instinctive thing and then gradually we kind of became more conscious?
Well, tracking that, the evolutionary course of human language is notoriously difficult and also very controversial. Mm-hmm. But we've got we can make some fairly good educated guesses. We can look at our closest relatives today, and they're pretty good at communicating with signs and gestures. They're not good at speaking. So chimps and bonobos, they don't make, I mean, they do. They do communicate with sound, but it's nothing compared to their visual communication. So we could speculate that perhaps our common ancestor also communicated visually, and then that as our communicative needs grew greater and greater, as our groups and societies became more and more complex, then our ancestors evolved a more sophisticated vocal communication because that's a richer way of communicating. So that's the sort of speculation that we could do. But I think with great apes, we tend to think that great apes do have intentionality, right? We're talking about very intelligent animals. We're talking about animals that live in, certainly the ones that are around today, they live in complex societies. They use communication to get along in a complex society. Most likely that's not instinctive. Most likely they have some sort of thought in their mind, maybe even a perception of themselves as being individuals and other animals as being separate individuals. That kind of makes sense, at least, even if it's not proven.
Yeah, that makes sense. So it does kind of raise a very fundamental question, which is what would the cutoff be point? At what point does intentionality arise? So like, even if everyone agrees that something like, I don't know, like a very small insect might not have that, and that apes do, somewhere in between, there has to be a turning point.
Well, you say that, of course, but I mean, evolutionary biologists don't like cutoffs and don't like having those kinds of firm distinctions. Everything's a continuum. I mean, occasionally there's some sort of evolutionary breakthrough and things evolve really fast. But even so, they're evolving fast. They're not changing suddenly. And it seems sudden in the sort of evolutionary record, because it maybe took 1,000 years or 10,000 years, which is overnight. But these things always happen gradually. So no, I don't feel comfortable saying, well, oh, this animal has consciousness and this animal doesn't, or this animal has intentional communication and this animal doesn't. I think that when you think about your pet dog, for instance, and you might be able to hear mine in the background there. But when you think about your pet dog, it's not hard to argue that your dog has some level of, certainly not hard to argue your dog has consciousness. And I think most people would feel comfortable arguing that their dog had intentionality. Now, that may not be intentionality according to some strict laboratory definition. And we can argue about whether that really is intentional, and whether they have a theory of mind, and whether they know that you are someone separate from them, and so on. But it's clear that they have something that's more than an insect, and something that's sufficiently complex that we feel comfortable calling it some sort of intentionality. So I don't think there's just a strict cutoff on it. You know, we have it, and these ones don't. There does seem to be quite a large range.
Yeah, that makes sense. So as you move towards studying communication and in wolves and dolphins and other species, at what point did you decide that you want to try and generalize this and think, you know, could this apply to other life like outside of Earth?
Yeah, that kind of came on rather surprisingly. And thanks to actually one individual, a guy by the name of Lawrence Doyle at SETI Institute. So I was running a workshop on animal communication, and this guy wrote to me and said, look, I'm a physicist. I'm not a biologist. I want to come to your workshop anyway, because his field is looking for signals from alien intelligences. And he felt, and still feels, that looking at how animals communicate is an essential prerequisite for being able to understand alien communication. Now, that's a huge field. Okay, that's not a simple question, but talking to him and having him at the workshop and then later collaborating further, it did start me thinking about some important questions. So, firstly, is there something like a fingerprint for language, right? I don't know whether dolphins have a language. I don't think they do, but they might. Is there something I can look for that would tell me yes or no, right? Is there something statistical, some sort of mathematical analysis I can do on dolphin communication or wolf communication or parrot communication and say, okay, I'm going to run this test and it will tell me whether or not this is a language. If there is such a thing, then clearly that's really, really useful if we're looking at signals from outer space, because we get some kind of crazy messed up signal. Is it a language? Maybe are they sending something intentionally, not intentionally? That would be a really useful thing. So you could see that there's this sort of overlap, and the two sides are feeding off each other. And the questions that he was asking got me interested in asking those same questions, but about animals on Earth.
Right. So, does such a thing exist, what you were just proposing?
So this is what we're looking for, but from what I've seen and from the research that we've done so far, I can't give you a definite answer on that. But the sort of progress that we've made has been to say, well, there are probably necessary but not sufficient indicators of language. So probably any alien species or animal species that has a true language like ours will show certain statistical characteristics in their communication. But a lot of animals show those characteristics. So it's not just for language, but it's probably a prerequisite for language. So there are some things like, the main one that I think most people have thought about is that we're pretty sure that language needs to be a balance between complexity and simplicity. Because there's absolutely no point in having a simple language, right? Language is there to communicate complex ideas. If you can't do that, it's not a language. And strangely, there's not much point in having a complex language because, you know, all species are subjected to evolutionary trade-offs. If you gain something, you have to pay for it somewhere else. So if you had a really complex language, you'd have to have a really huge brain. And language gives you, or complex communication gives you, incremental benefits in your social interactions. So having a huge brain wouldn't pay off if you're only getting a little bit of benefit. So we kind of think that if language is evolving naturally, it's going to be balanced somewhere between complexity and simplicity. And it turns out you can quantify that mathematically. And we know that human languages are perfectly balanced between complexity and simplicity. So that's kind of been a bit of a clue that might be a common characteristic of language. Mm-hmm. Necessary, but not sufficient.
Yeah, that has me wondering about the complexity of human language because, well, you say it's perfectly balanced, but it seems like 90% of all of our communication is with, like, you know, these very common words, and you can pull up a dictionary and most people might not recognize just a whole bunch of words. So that seems like excess complexity. So why do you think that evolved?
Because they're rare. That's why it's not excess complexity. So the standard analysis in this case is to look exactly at that. Look at word frequencies and see exactly mm-hmm. how often a word is used. And you see that the commonest word in English is the, right? And the second commonest word is and. And the second uh-huh. commonest word is half as common as the commonest. So and is used half as much as the. The third most common word is used a third as much as the. And the fourth most common word is used a fourth as much, quarter. And mm-hmm. the thousandth most common word is used one thousandth as much as the. And that's really weird, right? So that's strange. But that's a particular kind of statistical distribution, which is known to be, which is very characteristic kind of statistical distribution. And so many people have looked for the same pattern in animals, and you do see it in some, right? So you do see it in some. It's we call it balance between complexity and simplicity because you can imagine the opposite case would be if you always say the, right? The, and you hardly ever say anything else. That's a simple language, okay?
Right.
The only one thing you can say there, the. A complex language, a truly complex language from an information theoretical perspective, and this all comes back to information theory, is one where every word is equally common. So mm-hmm. if every word is equally common, so now just imagine that, you know, we say the and we say and, but we're just like as likely to say, you know, proprioception or querulous. That all those words are equally mm-hmm. likely. That's impossibly difficult to understand. Such a language would be an absolute nightmare. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the distribution that we see in English, in fact, in all human languages, you see the same thing, is the nice balance.
Mm-hmm. So it's a similar pattern across all languages.
Yeah, almost identical. Yeah.
Wow. It's very interesting. How about synonyms? Like, especially very, very, very close synonyms that you would think that maybe just one word would do instead of two or more.
Well, so, I mean, this is really the field of linguistics, mm-hmm. which is not my field. I'm not just trying to, you know, get out of answering the question, but it is important to distinguish between these different timescales. So language per se, language as in human language, evolved on an evolutionary timescale. I mean, pretty recently, but say 100,000 years or so, order of magnitude. So that was a process that culminated in a language ability which really distinguished humans from other species. Now, since then, different human languages have been evolving, but through a very different process. I mean, the So obviously the best example is English. In English is a combination of French and German, but you know, Latin languages and Saxon languages from the Norman invasion of England and from the Anglo-Saxons and so on. So, so there's this mixing of different languages. And of course there are synonyms because you've got one from Saxon and one from French. So those processes are very different processes from the ones we see evolutionarily. It's all about the cultural evolution that takes place in human societies, which kind of parallels, but is very different from organic evolution that takes place in an organism.
So if you're focusing on language as opposed to communication more generally, it's more of a historical study than like a biological study.
Well, it's they're just very different processes. Those processes have very different characteristics. In organic evolution, traits are passed down from parent to children biologically, genetically. Whereas our cultural evolution can take place, you know, it's not just between parents and children. If you have a TV anchor who's got a huge following, he could spread the way that he talks to all of those people. So it has, although the processes are similar, they're really very different in the way they play out.
Do you need to reach a certain level of biological complexity before cultural evolution can work? Or is this something that you'll see in other animals where they're passing down things like not biologically, but just through learning?
That's an excellent question. That is a good question. It's probably not framed quite right, because cultural evolution in the broadest sense, in terms of non-genetic transmission of information, can occur in relatively simple organisms, conceivably, particularly when it concerns a very specific task. Okay, so if you have a bird and it wants to break into some kind of food supply, and it figures out a way to do it, another bird sees that, copies it, and learns. It doesn't need to be the child of that teacher or demonstrator. But when it comes to very specific tasks, cultural transmission can take place. What is very different is the kind of cultural transmission that we see in those animals that have a more complex cognitive ability and cognitive social lifestyle. So then we see instances of teaching, and we see sort of this wider scale use of learning and cultural transmission across different tasks, not just for one task, not just how to do one thing. So for instance, and I'll give this as an example, if you take chimpanzee societies, okay, a baby chimpanzee needs to learn how to behave, right? Needs to learn how to behave amongst its peers to be successful in the society and not get into too many fights, and how to work its way up the social ladder. That's not something that is entirely genetically transmitted. It might be partially genetically transmitted. This is something that they learn from observing other animals, a wide range of skills: how to find food, how to fish for termites, how to react when someone is threatening you, you know, how to threaten someone else. So that kind of broader range of cultural transmission of ideas that we see primarily in more social and more cognitively complex species.
That's very interesting. How does this relate to your work on the evolution of cooperation?
Well, I mean, cooperation and communication obviously there are a lot of links between them. It's difficult to cooperate if you can't communicate. And in some senses, communication, a lot of communication that we see is about cooperation. Not all of it. There's no doubt that there is, among the animals at least, there's a lot of communication that is purely deceptive, right? I don't care whether you benefit or not. I'm just going to communicate for the sake of influencing you. But a lot of animals cooperate. They cooperate mostly if they're family. So, you know, it's obviously going to help your children because your children are your genetic representation in future generations. So there are other cases where you might cooperate as well. So it's in those social animals that you see communication starting to be used in a more complex way to support cooperation. And that's why we look to those really cooperative species when we study complex communication. That's why we're interested in dolphins. It's not just because they make a lot of sounds and they're very intelligent. It's because they're very social and they cooperate. In wolves as well, much less complex communication, but these are cooperating animals. They need to cooperate and they need to communicate to cooperate.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of rare so far, haven't discovered many cases of really detailed communication to instruct other animals in your cooperation. I mean, that's something that is pretty close to being unique to humans. We think there are a couple of examples in the animal world there may be more, but it's not common to find animals that say, okay, you go to the left, you go to the right, and I'll chase the deer straight ahead. That doesn't happen or mm-hmm. doesn't happen much.
Uh-huh. So then is cooperation usually a marker of like some level of intentionality, or are there processes that'll happen more automatically that will look cooperative to us?
I think the biggest kind of cooperation that you see is just social cohesion, right? It's when we say cooperation, most of the cooperation that we observe is keeping the wheels of society turning, right? So these are dominance and submissive signals. This is sentinel behavior. The sort of things that you see a lot of animals doing when they live in a group that are just what's necessary for the group to be a successful group. You know, it's just like if I don't cooperate, then everything goes to hell and I lose as well as everyone else. It's those sort of social signals that are the most common. And then when you say intentional signals, that can have a couple of different interpretations. One is the sort of you go to the left, I'll go to the right, and we'll catch the deer like that. As I said, that's rare. That's really, really rare. The other sort of communication, which you might call an intentional communication, or certainly has been researched a lot as if it might be an intentional communication, are, let's say I find some food. And now I call others to come and share my food with me. Well, you know, I've got to make that decision. Do I call them or do I not call them?
Mm-hmm.
And that's quite a difficult decision because there are pros and cons. It's to do with like, will it help to protect me against predators? If everyone is here feeding, if it's a big bush, there's lots of food. So everyone come and then I'm safer. Or maybe if there's very little food, I don't want to tell anyone because I know that the dominant male will come and take it away. So
mm-hmm.
it's those sorts of situations that those are the ones that people often investigate for intentionality and to see, like, is this something that we think that there's a more detailed cognitive process going on?
Uh-huh. I've read about even in honeybees, they'll do this little dance to communicate in what direction the nectar is. Although that I'm less inclined looking at a tiny little bee to say that they're intentionally doing that. It seems more like this kind of instinctual thing.
Yeah, and I would agree. I mean,
yeah.
Again, I think that communication, all animals have communication, the smallest to the largest. And so we shouldn't be surprised that honeybees communicate, okay, because it benefits them. It benefits each of them if they find honey. And so you can see how a situation like that would evolve, and it doesn't require intentionality. It doesn't require consciousness, however you want to define that. Some definitions of consciousness it doesn't require. It gets trickier to work with when we think that a type of communication doesn't seem like it can be explained just by instinctive behavior, and then we need to do some experiments and try and figure it out. It's quite mm-hmm. difficult.
That makes sense. So it seems like communication for the most part has a lot of benefits. So, and you do mention that all animals have it to some degree, but what are the downsides to the animals that have very limited communication to let's say evolving more?
Well, it's you know, it's a sort of classic a fallacy that people have, which is that, oh, isn't it better to be more intelligent than less? Why aren't all animals intelligent? And again, it's a zero-sum game. You're trading off. You've got to trade something off. We've got to you will evolve let's bring it back to sort of the fundamental mechanism of evolution. I have some babies. Some of them are more intelligent. Some of them are less intelligent. Now, which ones are going to survive? Which ones are going to be more successful? Well, you might think that the more intelligent ones will be more successful, but not necessarily. I mean, maybe they don't have real challenges to them. You know, if they're like worms just swimming around on the bottom of a stream, then it's not immediately clear that those intelligent worms will actually survive better. And they are paying a price, right? So if they've got a bigger brain, if they've got a bigger brain, then that uses more energy. I mean, it's just like, why have a big brain if all you're doing is crawling along the mud? So you can see that in some cases, intelligence wouldn't evolve. There are other mechanisms by which intelligence doesn't evolve, and that's to do with the fact that intelligence is used to solve problems, and it's often used to make predictions. Mm-hmm. Now, if it's important to make predictions in your environment, it might really help you to be intelligent. But there's sometimes when making predictions is a really bad idea. Okay, so let's say that I want to know whether it's going to be a hot summer or a cold summer. So you'd have thought that if I had a brain that could like look at the time that the leaves fall and when the birds migrate and things like that, I could predict whether it's going to be a hot summer or a cold summer. But if it's always a hot summer, I mean, if it's almost never a cold summer, why bother? You know, well, sometimes prediction always has an error. So I might see the leaves falling and watch the birds migrating and say, okay, it's going to be a cold summer. And it's not, because it never is. So you can go wrong with predictions. And having the intelligence to make predictions only is an advantage if, on average, you're benefiting from that. But if making those guesses and making errors is a big drawback, don't evolve it.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so is it typically intelligence typically correlated with how social a species is, or are there any examples of very intelligent but solitary animals?
Intelligence is another word that it's a big word that covers actually a lot of different traits, a lot of different characteristics. So, you know, we like to use it. We like to ask, how intelligent is that animal? But it's probably inappropriate, because there are different kinds of intelligence. So there is intelligence to do with solving problems, very immediate problems. You know, how do I open this nut? You know, how do I get the honey out of the hive? And there are animals that have that problem-solving intelligence. And it can have many different facets. It can be to do with learning as well as, you know, how well you learn from experience and things like that. And that's one thing. Let's put that on one side and we can call that general intelligence if you like. It's kind of similar to a lot of things that people test with IQ tests and things like that. But there's another kind of intelligence, which is the one that drove, so we think, the one that really drove the cognitive advances that we see in our own lineage, and that's social intelligence. And that's not the same thing, okay? So that same chimpanzee that knows, you know, should I annoy this one here, or I'll get into a fight, or perhaps if I make friends with this big chimpanzee, then he can help me when I fight against that one. That kind of social intelligence is not the same as problem-solving intelligence. And that obviously, you know, you get in social animals, you don't get the point in having that kind of social intelligence in a tiger who never meets anyone except a mate. So they are different things. They are different things, and they serve different purposes, and they evolve for different reasons. And yeah, we kind of think that it's that social intelligence that really pushed all of the primates, most of the great apes anyway, and certainly our lineage along the line to what we now call, you know, human intelligence.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of thinking about alien life, I guess it seems like we can imagine two different types. One is like really just any alien life that's not too sophisticated and we might never know if it exists. And then the other type, the more interesting one, is like intelligent alien life that it might actually be able to communicate with us. So it seems like for them, they would require that sort of social intelligence.
Yeah, I accept that. I mean, I think we can go a lot further than that. We can say we can expect alien life to have the whole spectrum of what we see on this planet, right? Mm-hmm. They'll have bugs, and they'll have dolphins, and they'll have birds, and they'll have great apes. And there's no reason not to find that sort of diversity. Now, what I think you're really asking is the distinction between technological intelligence and everyone else. Because if we want to talk to them, unless we go there, it doesn't seem to be any sign we're going to do that, then we need to communicate through technology. So there's aliens that have technology, and there's aliens that don't. And of course, the aliens that don't, so the vast, vast, vast majority. You know, there was 3.5 billion years of life on Earth before anyone got technology. So, you know, mm-hmm. The chances of finding just that right point in the evolution of life on another planet, it's pretty small. But anyway, there are lots of planets. So intelligent life on other planets, absolutely, all the whole spectrum. Technological intelligence, technologically capable species on another planet, will they have to be social? Yeah, I'd say they absolutely would. I'd say they absolutely would. And it, just from the perspective of you know, how much can one individual do? You need help. Yeah, you need help to build a spaceship. But more importantly, it's only in social groups that kind of intelligence will evolve. I mean, I could put all kinds of caveats on that, because you know, a situation where you evolve into a group, and the group somehow forms a mega or meta organism and things like that. But from an evolutionary perspective, step by step, yeah, that social stage seems to be absolutely key.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. So I want to talk about the idea that, people say evolution is a random process, but it seems more like it's the mutations, I guess, are random, but the selection mechanism seems fixed. So for example, anything that's maybe more energy efficient might outcompete something that's less energy efficient. So it seems like that's maybe akin to a natural law. I don't know if you'd want to call it that. And then there's other things that seem to show up in these fixed patterns. I don't really have a specific question. I'd just like to talk about what are some things that are universal, like not just like communication that's a universal pattern, but like more universal in a law-like sense, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And it's a point that people struggle with all the time. I understand, because it is a bit of a difficult concept to get. So first things first, evolution, random process, not random process. I don't know. Let's describe it like this and tell me what you think. Imagine you've got a great big table, right? Or a board, and it's very bumpy. It's got, you know, it's got dips in it, and it's got, it's not random, but it's got little holes, and it's got hills and things like that. It's just a random, it's sort of mm-hmm. this lumpy landscape. And you put a bunch of balls on this table and you shake it around. Mm-hmm. Okay. Not too hard, but you shake it a little bit. But what you'll find is that the balls will tend to accumulate in the dips.
Yeah.
Right. Not always in the deepest dip, but sometimes they'll be in a shallow one. They won't be sitting on top of the hills. They'll roll down into the dips. This is the way that the evolution works. Okay. The randomness, there is some randomness there. That's the shaking. The shaking is just random. But that mm-hmm. randomness is arranging itself on top of some constraints. And the constraints are the dips in the table. Mm-hmm. So what kind of constraints might those be that are like focusing the evolutionary process into a particular direction? The ball's right. going down this one because there's a constraint. So they can be physical constraints. I mean, they could be literal constraints of the laws of physics. You know, you can't levitate or something like that. There's a lot of constraints about the sort of the biochemical basis of things. But really, there are two kinds of interesting constraints. One is a constraint that is developmental. So organisms evolve new characteristics on top of what they've already got. Big changes don't usually happen in evolution. Usually if you suddenly get an extra arm or something like that, it's not going to work. You're going to die because You know, mm-hmm. your blood supply gets messed up in your nerves and everything like that. So things evolve, small changes on top of what they already have. So one of the constraints is what I already have. So if you live in a world where, for instance, as in our world, the majority of animals are bilaterally symmetrical, so you've got a left side and a right side, you're pretty much constrained to have a left side and a right side. You're not going to go anywhere different. So it's a developmental mm-hmm. constraint on how you're going to look. And then the other kind of constraint, which shapes the different kinds of solutions that there could be, is the ecological constraint. So what are you interacting with? You're interacting with your food, right? You're interacting with others of your same species. You're interacting with your predators. Everyone's out to eat you one way or another. So those sorts of interactions also drive the kinds of traits that evolve. So if you think about something like flight, okay, it's subject to all of these constraints. It's subject to the constraints of physics, obviously, because you can't fly by levitating. You know, you've got to stick to the laws of physics. Mm-hmm. It's constrained by the ecological laws because it's really useful if someone's coming to eat me and I can fly away. That's not necessarily why flight evolved, but maybe it is. Mm-hmm. Then that's really useful. You know, if I could, most likely evolve something like I could jump off a tree and not splat on the ground, right? And somehow slow my descent. So mm-hmm. so those ecological constraints dictate that flight is a good thing in general. It's a good thing. And so we can expect to see that also on alien planets. And we can expect that how those animals fly will be according to the same laws of physics that constrain how our animals fly. Uh-huh. And then for the developmental constraint, but that's where it gets a little bit different, because we don't know that flying animals on another planet will have built their flying ability on the same basis of the same starting point that our flying organisms had, which was being bilaterally symmetrical. So you've got two wings, right? Mm-hmm. Like I say, it's good to have two wings, you know, you can see why that's a good thing, but we can't be sure that that's what will happen on other planets, because they may be evolving from an organism that's not bilaterally symmetrical. Mm-hmm. Although I think that's unlikely, but there's an example. So those constraints are what are funneling evolutionary solutions into similar sorts of directions.
Uh-huh. So with your example, with the little bumps and the balls falling into the bumps, you could imagine maybe a ball in like a very shallow valley, and then there's another valley nearby it, and it goes into an even larger dip. And I'm thinking about flight in this case. So you could imagine a bird that can't fly and maybe doesn't have wings yet. So like really a distant ancestor of a bird, and it has to invest energy into developing these wings. And there's a massive payoff, which is flight, in that dip way later on, but you have to invest all of the energy to get wings before you actually fly. So how do you get that initial push?
Yeah, so there's two answers to that. The first one is a little bit mathematical, but okay, I gave this example of the table with all the bumps, right? But you've got to imagine that there are so many different characteristics that can vary. I mean, like everything from, you know, the length of your fur to the length of your teeth, all these different characteristics vary. And when you have that what we would call a high dimensionality, then there are many more pathways to get over those bumps, right? So you could do it other ways. But that's the less interesting answer. The more interesting answer is that what we actually see in evolution is most of the time, these really, really interesting innovations come on the back of something unrelated. So in the case of flight, right, feathers, talk about feathers rather than wings first, feathers did not evolve for flight. Feathers evolved to keep dinosaurs warm. This is what we think at the moment. So you got all these feathery dinosaurs running around, right? And then one of them is running around trying to get away from a T-Rex, one of them jumps off a cliff. And because they've got so many feathers, right, they glide down and they don't splat on the ground. So feathers evolve their role in flight on the back of a different role that they had, and they had evolved for something completely different. That happens a lot. So we look at wings and feathers and things like that. Wow, how did they get those feathers so perfectly evolved for flight? No, the feathers started off being for something completely different, and then they just slowly got adapted for what we see them being used for now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. What are some examples of that with humans, if you know of any?
Examples of
things that we evolved for one reason and then maybe later started using for another reason. Like, for example, communication or our capacity for language. That seems like it required a very large energy investment. And I'm not sure if it had immediate payoff. So did that evolve for some other reason? And then later we started getting benefits out of it.
I mean, I think you can certainly argue that what we consider to be our intellectual capabilities probably didn't provide a huge benefit at the beginning. So language is a great example, because people used to think, okay, why is language great? Language is great because I could say, okay, we're going to hunt this mammoth, right? Okay, you're going to go on the left and I'm going to go on the right, and then he's going to come and stab the mammoth with a spear. And if you can explain that to everyone, then you're better off at hunting mammoths. But that's probably not what happened. Okay, what we think now is probably language, again, evolved on the back of this social intelligence. So we started living in groups, we started hunting mammoths, we started working together. And what was really important was the ability to understand that I'm going to go to, straight ahead and you're going to go to the left and he's going to go to the right. And then that understanding, which requires me to understand that I'm an individual and these are two different individuals, that understanding built the foundation on which language itself could develop, because there are people who argue that you can't have language without a sense of self, without a sense of self and other. And, you know, whether that's true or not, I'm not sure. But the point is that a lot of our intellectual and cognitive abilities probably didn't give us much of an advantage when everyone was living in caves. And they just developed later on top of the sort of social intelligence that was necessary for living in a group in the Ice Age.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. The last thing I want to talk about is that you mentioned in your book is evolutionary game theory and how that relates to certain behaviors sort of emerging convergently in a lot of different species and potentially in alien life.
Sure. Anything in particular, or just do you want me to give you some examples?
Maybe a brief overview of what it is for our listeners, and then we could talk about some examples.
Right. So the key thing to remember about evolutionary game theory is that everyone understands more or less that, you know, if you've got a tiger with longer teeth, then it's better at catching its prey, right? That's got to be a good thing. That's easy enough. Mm-hmm. The key thing about game theory is that quite often, it's not just what you have that's important, longer teeth, longer legs, whatever. It's what everyone else has. And then depending on what everyone else has, that might change what's best for you. So obvious example is, let's say that we have a butterfly or an insect, a fly that doesn't want to get eaten by a bird. So it gets itself yellow stripes, right? So it looks like a wasp and the bird is like, oh no, I don't want to eat this. This is going to sting me. Sounds great. It's great for the bird. But now let's say that everyone thinks, oh wow, isn't that great? Let's all have yellow stripes. So all the flies now have yellow stripes. Right, what's the bird going to do? The bird's going to be like, those juicy flies have yellow stripes. Let's eat the things with yellow stripes. Now I'm a fly that doesn't have yellow stripes in a community that's all faking it with its yellow stripes. I'm at an advantage. Bird's not looking for me. Bird's looking for the other ones. Uh-huh. So what's the best coloration to have depends on what everyone else has. If everyone else is being honest, it's best for me to fake it. If everyone is faking, it's best for me to be honest. And so game theory is a way of quantifying and making predictions about how you should behave depending on how everyone else is behaving. Not just how you should behave, you know. Should I have long legs? Yeah. But maybe if everyone has long legs, it's better for me to have short legs. So game theory is one of those. It's particularly important when you start having social behavior, because then you really are, you're interacting with a lot of other animals who, you know, basically have the same sort of requirements as you do. And then the way that you behave or whatever traits and characteristics you have, the best way for you to behave depends on what everyone else is doing. And the key finding of of sort of the famous finding of evolutionary game theory is that oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes there's a stable compromise. It's just like, okay, 10% of the flies will have yellow stripes and 90% won't. And that's like best for everyone in the sense that, you know, I can't do any better. If I try having kids with lots of stripes, then they won't do as well as if I stick to that, that percentage. So it's a very interesting way of explaining sometimes unexpected behaviors and things that look like they're planned in advance, but they're really not.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And how would that apply to alien life? I mean, it seems like it's a universal principle that would work everywhere, but would it lead to any interesting predictions that we might not expect?
Well, that's the thing, that it's a nice law of behavior that is going to be universal, because you see, evolution acts in a way so that you benefit if your offspring are successful and so on. So those behaviors that you evolve, those characteristics and behaviors that you evolve, whatever planet you're on, doesn't matter, everyone's going to be using evolution. So whatever planet you're on, those behaviors are the ones that are going to give you the best outcomes. And that's not always easy to predict what that's going to be. Game theory will tell us certain things, like, for instance, if I have a society of organisms and some of them are aggressive and some of them are passive, then there are cases in which, you know, a balance works out. A balance is better. Obviously, if everyone is passive and you're the aggressive one, then you win out over everyone. But if everyone is aggressive, you know, and you sit back and have a quiet life and you don't pick fights with everyone, then you're the one who's winning out. So we should expect aliens to show exactly those same kinds of tendencies that are predicted by some very simple game theory rules here.
It's very interesting. Arik, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It's been great fun.
Yep. And make sure to check out The Zoologist's Guide to the Galaxy. And I'll let you plug anything else if you have anything else you want to share.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.